Exodus chapter 17, verses 8 through 16, in which Israel fights Amalek. If you've been following along chronologically, you know that this message is the third part of a series on problems Israel encountered in the wilderness on the way to Mount Sinai. Previously, we discussed their need for water, which God met, and then we discussed their need for food, which God met. Today, we will be discussing the external human problem, that is, the threat of warfare, and next week we'll discuss the internal human problem, that is, the threat of social strife. In doing so, we will have an opportunity to discuss the Amalekites, a recurring enemy of Israel. We will also gain some insights into Moses' position as leader of the Israelites and concerning his relationship to God. Today's passage is short, so I will read it from the NIV. The Amalekites came and attacked the Israelites at Rephidim. Moses said to Joshua, "Choose some of our men and go out to fight the Amalekites. Tomorrow I will stand on top of the hill with the staff of God in my hands." So Joshua fought the Amalekites as Moses had ordered, and Moses, Aaron, and Hur went to the top of the hill. As long as Moses held up his hands, the Israelites were winning, but whenever he lowered his hands, the Amalekites were winning. When Moses' hands grew tired, they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it. Aaron and Hur held up his hands, one on one side, one on the other, so that his hands remained steady till sunset. So Joshua overcame the Amalekite army with the sword. Then Jehovah said to Moses, "Write this on a scroll as something to be remembered, and make sure that Joshua hears it, because I will completely blot out the name of Amalek from under heaven." Moses built an altar and called it "Jehovah is my banner." He said, "Because hands were lifted up against the throne of Jehovah, Jehovah will be at war against the Amalekites from generation to generation." So the passage begins with "the Amalekites came." Who were these Amalekites? The Amalekites are first mentioned in Genesis chapter 14. In that chapter, it is said that the country which they occupied was subdued by Chedorlaomer. That gives us the impression that at that time, they were already an established people, and this is as early as the days of Abraham, mind you, so they had possibly been around since before his time. We don't have them listed in the table of nations descended from Noah in Genesis chapter 10, so if they are that old, we can't be sure of their exact lineage. It is possible, though, that the Amalekites were descended from Edom, based on a reference in Genesis 36 to a son of Esau named Amalek. If that is the case, then we would reconcile the passage in Genesis 14 by noting that Moses might be describing not the people of Amalek as having been conquered by Chedorlaomer, but is instead describing the territory which Chedorlaomer conquered by anachronistically associating it with the Amalekites who lived there in his own time period. It's a little like I might call France, France, and say that Caesar conquered France. Well, Caesar really fought with the Gauls in the land that is now France, but you see how it works. So the Amalekites have been around for a fair amount of time and have an established territory by the time of Moses. Evidently, the Amalekites lived in the northern part of the Sinai Peninsula, and their territory extended north into the Promised Land, so it seems to me that they must have traveled south to catch Israel as the Israelites moved south toward Mount Sinai. I suppose they might have heard that the escaped slaves were passing by, and must have thought that they would be easy pickings. No such luck, however. This is probably the most famous battle in the Bible of Amalek, but there will be recurring villains, particularly of the sidekick sort. In Judges chapter 3, they will team up with Eglon, king of Moab, in attacking Israel. In Judges chapter 6, they will help the Midianites raid Israel until Gideon takes them to task. King Saul will also go to war against Amalek. God will order him at that time to completely wipe them out, but Saul will disobey by failing to do so. The Amalekites will make one successful raid against David before he becomes king, but David will overcome them in the end. It seems that the Amalekites will survive until they are finally wiped out entirely during the reign of King Hezekiah by men from the land of Judah. That is the last mention of them made in the Bible. In verse 9, Moses calls on a man named Joshua and orders him to choose men who can fight against Amalek. Now, this is the first mention of Joshua in the Bible, but if you know much about the book, you know that Joshua will be a character of much renown. He will later serve as a spy for Israel and will be one of the two most faithful ones. And thereafter, he will, in fact, have a book named after him following the Torah. That book recounts his military exploits, the best known of these being his conquest of the city of Jericho, in which, you probably remember, the walls came a-tumbling down. But for now, he's still 40 years away from that famous battle. He's fresh out of slavery like everyone else, and likely has no military experience. He is being thrust out onto the battlefield to defend his people against an advancing horde. And the battle plan is this. Moses is planning to hold up his staff. I suppose that even for an inexperienced soldier like Joshua, knowing that Moses will have his staff held up is enough to give him all the confidence he needs. After all, the last time Moses held up this staff, the waters of the sea parted in two, and before that the staff was used to bring plagues on Egypt. Surely it can beat a few raiding Amalekites. Now, the staff is nothing special in itself. The staff is special only because it represents the power of God. It was God, after all, who brought the plagues and split the sea, but the staff was the tool for doing his work, and when the staff was in the hand of his representative Moses and was being raised, one could well expect that God would act. So Joshua didn't doubt it. When the time for the battle came, Joshua gathered his men and went to fight Amalek. And of course, this was a battle not at all like the ones we are accustomed to today. Today, of course, wars are fought with intercontinental ballistic missiles, superior air power, drones, and guns that can hit an enemy fighter from a mile away. This was a much more harrowing kind of warfare. It was men with swords and shields and whatever they could find to stab or bludgeon each other to death. This was a time when no one moved faster than a horse could carry him, and no one shot farther than an arrow could fly from a bow, not much better than what you might give a child to play with in the backyard. We expect that even with the crude state of arms in those days, the Israelites were significantly outmatched in terms of weapons. Remember, the Israelites aren't an army. They are escaping slaves. They are people with children and wives and livestock, people who are accustomed to doing as they are told and being beaten into submission if they don't. They're living out of tents here, not fortresses. I would suppose that they have some horses, but probably not many, and likely not the kind bred for war. We have no indication that there are any chariots among them, and while we might guess that they plundered some weapons, swords and knives and those sorts of things from the Egyptians, we don't know what they had. For all we know, they were fighting with not much more than the likes of a few plundered swords, some sharpened sticks, and slings made from torn scraps of fabric. We suppose, though, that the Amalekites are significantly better armed. The idea that they would go into battle completely on foot seems a little unrealistic, and surely they had at least some swords. I don't want to speculate too much about what the Amalekites had or didn't have, since the passage doesn't tell us, but it seems obvious to me that Israel was less than ideally armed in comparison. And aside from that, we suppose that these men are all experienced raiders who have done their fair share of killing. That said, these raiding Amalekites are probably the easiest opponent that Israel is going to face anytime soon. We know, for instance, that their opponents in the Promised Land have swords, shields, bows and arrows, horses, chariots, walled cities, and so forth. So outmatched as they are, a battle with the Amalekites makes for a good first fight. And in a sense, I think that we should look at this battle as God's way of weaning his people off the kind of direct involvement that he had in the plagues of Egypt. Listen, every day for them, just like every day for you, is not going to be a miraculous wonder. God just doesn't do things that way. God is going to expect his people to go out and do their own fighting at some point. So this battle gives them something to cut their teeth on. God will help the Israelites in this battle, but he won't do all the work for them. They'll get some fighting experience, and in winning the fight, they'll also acquire some of the much-needed weaponry and gear that they'll use in fighting their future battles. And so the battle begins. Israel, we expect, has been traveling south across the Sinai Peninsula. The Amalekites have been coming down at them, trailing from the north. Now, aside from divine intervention, the Israelites have one distinct advantage in that this is a defensive battle. They don't have to kill everyone in the Amalekite army. They just have to beat them badly enough to convince them that raiding Israelites' stuff isn't worthwhile. They have to kill and injure just enough that the Amalekites decide they have better things to do than keep fighting. Deuteronomy 25:17-19 describes that Amalek attacked Israel from behind and, quote, cut off the tail, killing the people who lagged behind. Evidently, some of the slow and weak were overrun by the Amalekites at some point before Israel's soldiers were aware of them, or before they were able to reach the back of the camp. These Amalekites are ruthless plunderers, not at all ashamed to raid on the sick, the elderly, and the children who lagged behind. As the battle begins, Moses goes up to the top of a hill where he can oversee the fighting, and he holds the staff up in the air. This, as we have mentioned, is the symbol of God's divine intervention, and with it Moses asks for and receives God's help in giving Israel's soldiers supernatural strength to win, and Amalek's soldiers a sudden weakness to lose the battle. A fine example of God's ability in controlling human mind and action, if you ask me. So the battle rages, with soldiers clashing against each other in a line on the northern side of Israel's camp. As long as Moses has his hands and the staff up, Israel is pushing back the Amalekites and racking up their number of kills. When the staff is lowered, they begin to fall back and to struggle. I suppose it was good training for the real battles that they'd be fighting before too long. But anyone who has attempted to hold something in the air for long, even just their own hand with nothing in it, will tell you that he can only do so for so long. And battles of this type could rage on all day, so Moses' hands get too tired to keep holding the staff. Evidently, the soldiers aren't the only ones who are going to have to learn to get tough and suck it up in the wilderness. Even Moses doesn't get divine help on everything. To help him, Aaron and Hur bring Moses a stone to sit on, and as he is sitting there, able to help him hold up his hands and the staff. Incidentally, this is maybe the only time that we ever see Hur in the Bible. The name is mentioned a few other places, but we have no definitive word that it's the same Hur as this Hur. And Aaron, of course, you know by now. With the help of Aaron and Hur, Moses is able to hold up his hands until the sun goes down, when the battle ended, presumably because it became too difficult to see. The Israelites have proven themselves able to give a strong defense. Amalek knows that they can't win any plunder without a fight now, and that fight isn't worth having. If there are any Amalekites remaining after the battle, they are now fleeing into the night. Israel has won their first fight. God made specific instructions that the occasion should be memorialized, and that the Amalekites were to be completely destroyed from under heaven thereafter. Wiped off the face of the earth, you might say. Deuteronomy 25:17-19 makes it clear that Israel is ordered to be the ones to wipe them out after they have settled themselves in the Promised Land. And, as we discussed previously, that is ultimately what happened several hundred years later. Moses also rightly declared in verse 16 of our current passage in Exodus that Jehovah will have war against Amalek from generation to generation. This turns out to be the case. In that place where the battle was held, Moses also built a memorial altar. Altars were stone piles which were used in sacrificing animals to God, and they were often built to memorialize occasions just like this one. He called the altar, in Hebrew, Jehovah Nissi, meaning, Jehovah is my banner. The banner, of course, is a flag of war, a standard or an ensign. It is used to rally the troops and direct them in battle. Jehovah, then, is the one who leads the people of Israel into battle. Now, there is a small translational issue in verse 16. We mentioned a throne in the NIV translation, and in the ESV we read that Moses said, "A hand upon the throne of Jehovah." That seems like a funny thing to say in this context. As it turns out, the word translated throne in this verse is only one letter different from the word translated banner in the verse before it. And this is the only instance of the word here translated throne in the entire Bible. So we get the idea that this might be a scribal slip of the pen. In looking at the two words, we're talking about the difference between a noon and a cough, comparable to the difference between, say, a lowercase n in English and a lowercase h. Make one of your lines too long while you're writing it by hand, and the meaning could accidentally change. If you want my opinion on it, the context makes it pretty clear that the intention was to say a hand on the banner of Jehovah, and the ESV does provide this as a possibility for us in the footnotes. I do appreciate, however, that the NIV and ESV took a firm translational position here of staying true to the text as they found it written. Whichever choice you think makes the most sense, a throne or a banner, I suppose is an open-hand issue, though. We should note that whatever the solution is, this extremely minor textual change has no relevance to any major doctrine or any essential detail of the Bible narrative whatsoever. So we have a few lessons today, and I will keep them relatively short. First off, Moses is clearly God's appointed leader. In the wilderness wanderings, this will come into question, but here we have a definitive indication of who God wants to lead. God not only chose Moses to lead the people out of Egypt, he has also chosen him to lead them in their wilderness wars there, and that is why Moses holds up the staff, and Moses gets credit for the victory. Even Aaron and Hur recognize this. One of them could have held the staff while Moses took a breather, but it was necessary that Moses be the one to hold the staff. In addition to that, we see that Moses, and indeed all of Israel, is nothing without God's help. Without God, Israel would have been quickly defeated by this band of Amalekite raiders. But because of God's help, and only because of God's help, they were able to win the battle. Likewise, Moses depends on God as a leader. Moses did not bring this people out of Egypt on his own, and he cannot sustain or defend them in the wilderness on his own. So we understand that he is not only God's chosen leader, but he is also dependent on God to do that job of leading. Indeed, I think we should agree that all great leaders who have great successes owe those great successes to God's help, regardless of whether or not they recognize that reality. In addition to depending on God, great leaders must also depend on the people around them. God may have appointed Moses to lead the people out of Egypt, but he isn't going to do everything for Moses. Like all good leaders, Moses will have to learn to share the burden of his leadership with the people around him. One of the marks of a great leader is the ability to delegate work to capable people. Today we see that Moses did this in appointing Joshua, a much younger man, to lead the battle rather than trying to do it himself. We also see that when Moses was unable to hold the staff on his own, he was not so proud that he could not allow someone else to help him hold it up, as Aaron and Hur did. Incidentally, we'll see Moses doing even more delegation of authority next week. And I hope that when you are in a difficult situation as Moses was, you will not be too proud to allow others to help you. And I hope that you will surround yourself with good people who can help you when you need them. Furthermore, I hope that you will be willing to make yourself available to help others when they need you, and particularly that you will help your leaders. Furthermore, I think that we should commend Aaron and Hur, not only in that they gave Moses help, but in that they did not usurp him. In this case, it is clear that God had appointed Moses to lead the people, and as such, it was Moses who held the staff. When Moses was weak, Aaron and Hur could have overtaken him, but neither Aaron nor Hur attempted to do so. They didn't try to hold the staff in their own hands. Rather, they helped Moses raise his hands to continue to bear the burden that God had given him. During their stay in the wilderness, there will be those who would like to take Moses' position away from him, but they will fail to do so. Here, Aaron and Hur made the right decision by getting behind God's plan instead of trying to usurp, and they were most useful that way. So then we have seen yet another trial of wandering in the wilderness, and it is a trial of warfare. The people of Israel have been victorious in defeating raiders from Amalek, and the Amalekites have been cursed with their eventual destruction. In the course of the battle, we have seen that the credit for the victory belongs only to God, who has appointed Moses as leader. We have also seen that God is a helper to his people, but that he will not continue to manifest himself so plainly for the rest of Israel's history. Instead, he will begin weaning Israel off of his power and training them both in the skills of battle and in the skills of working with and helping one another, so that they can be fully mature and prepared to take the promised land. Next week, we move on to our final trial on the way to Mount Sinai, that of social conflicts among fellow Israelites. For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.